This is the Bill Kelly Show podcast.
We're going to talk now about Discount Airlines. New Leaf embarks on its inaugural flight today from Hamilton's John C. Monroe International Airport to lovely downtown Moncton, New Brunswick, with the company finally taking flight. What are some of the things that we need to keep in mind about this new company? Well, one of the things I think we need to keep in mind is that there have been a lot of people try this model before out of Hamilton Airport and have failed. I hope that that doesn't happen this time. But Ian Lee joins us. He's from the Sprott School of Business, Carleton University. Ian, good to have you back on the show.
My pleasure, Jamie.
So this isn't something new. This is something that's been tried multiple times in Hamilton. And the last, and I'm there may have been one in between, but the last one I recall vividly was a company called Fly Globespan, which was offering flights to and from the UK that were dirt cheap, and I think they lasted about 15 minutes.
Right.
How do you make a go of being a discount airline in Canada in 2016?
It is possible. I've been teaching in my strategy class. I teach strategy in the business school, which is the fourth year mandatory course in most business schools and in the MBA program, whereby you analyze, you know, successful companies and unsuccessful companies in terms of their strategies. And of course, one of the industries that's very popular all the time with students is airlines, because people know it. And it's always, I mention this to you because it's probably one of the most studied industries in North America. People are fascinated by airlines. And so we have really, since going back to the late 70s, early 80s, we have, there's a lot of good case studies of real companies. So this isn't theory we're talking about. This is real-world companies. And those that have succeeded and those that have failed. And, of course, the two most famous startups, and they were startups at one point, that really blazed the way and set the model for the successful budget airline was Southwest Airlines and JetBlue in the United States. And they've become Harvard Business School case studies, by the way. And so I'm going to answer your question now. It is possible to compete against the so-called legacy airlines or the big airlines, the Air Canadas, the Deltas, the Uniteds, and so forth. But I think the secret, if we can call it that, is to try to avoid as much as possible competing head-to-head in the biggest airport. So, I mean, Southwest started very famously, and even to this day, it often flies into so-called Tier 2 airports. That's not to put them down. So they flew in for a very long time into Oakland instead of San Francisco, which, of course, Oakland is just across the bay.
But right.
It's a completely different airport. They used to fly into John Wayne Airport instead of LAX, Los Angeles International. And they got a lot of advantages flying into a Tier 2 airport. The landing fees are typically much, much lower. You can see where I'm going with this, Hamilton versus Pearson in Toronto. And they're far less congested, and there's lots of people who don't mind going into a Tier 2 airport. And I want to emphasize again, this is not a slur or a put-down of the Hamilton airport. It's just simply that there are some very, very major airports in this country. We know about them. The big one, of course, is Pearson.
Yeah,
and I get the market is willing to go to Tier 2 airports.
I get that, Ian.
That's part of the secret.
I get that, but it's pretty risky for somebody to try to start an airline and hope that you get the volume of passengers you need to keep it going, because even flying into a Tier 2 airport and fueling up jet aircraft, it's the overhead's pretty expensive. And how do you calculate that risk if you're the owners of New Leaf or whatever the latest discount airline is? Why do people go into that business? Because they just seem to fail at a rapid rate.
Warren Buffett had told a funny story. It's a great story. And he actually told this story. He said in a lecture he gave once as a guest lecturer at a business school in the States, he said in 1906, somebody, he said, should have shot Orville Wright at Kitty Hawk when he flew the first airplane, because he said if somebody had shot him and stopped the airline industry from coming into existence, he said he would have saved billions and billions of dollars in all the losses. The commercial industry in the United States, air aviation, from the beginning until the present, has lost more money than it has made. And so You know, he was asked, well, then why on earth do people invest in airlines? And he said, it's just, you know, irrationality.
Right.
But to answer your question very quickly, I mean, to finish off that point, it's not just flying into a tier two airport. It's making sure you only use one plane, not three or four planes, so you don't have all the extra overhead of spare parts. And of course, Southwest is famous for only flying one plane, the 737. They do not fly multiple different planes. And then another is to schedule them again at times of the day when you're not competing against the Air Canadas and the WestJets. And so, and finally, another strategy of these discount airlines is to strip out all the benefits, strip out all the costs. So you monetize everything, and I mean everything. You want a pillow, it's going to cost you. You want a soft drink, it's going to cost you. You want anything, it's going to cost you. So all you're selling is the seat on the chair.
Right.
And that's it. And so you can do it, but you have to pay ruthless attention to cost control. You know, Virgin has done this for quite some time, and some other deep discount airlines. And you monetize everything, and of course you advertise like crazy, and you compete on price.
Okay.
You make sure you come underneath the Air Canadas and the WestJet.
Then let's talk about how we view things differently. You know, this sort of model is said to be wildly popular in Europe. I used EasyJet in Europe when I was there in 2009. And yeah, it went, and everything went fine, and in other places. But we think a little bit differently here in Canada, and I'm afraid that the deep discount airlines have become branded as unreliable airlines, and people in Canada want reliability, meaning we want to know that when we buy a ticket, whether that ticket is $59 or $599, that plane's going to be there and that I'll be able to get on it and it'll be able to take me to where I'm going to go. And I'm afraid that the brand that discount airlines, deep discount airlines, have established for themselves and created for themselves is unreliability. I buy a ticket, next thing I know I get to the airport, there's no plane, we're done, the airline's out of business. And that's a problem, isn't it, if you're trying to start something up?
As somebody who flies fairly regularly, I could not agree with you more. I have had this experience, and not flying discount airlines, by the way, flying on Air Canada, where you show up at the airport 2 hours in advance, and then they either tell you, I'm sorry, the flight is overbooked, and we're putting you on another flight, even though you don't want to go on another flight, or you show up at the airport, and you get on the plane, and then you sit on the tarmac for 4 or 5 or 6 hours before the plane departs. And I've had that experience, too. And that's what I call unreliability. The good news, bad news in this story is that for a startup airline, is that the unreliability problem, it plagues Air Canada and WestJet just as much as it plagues the startup airline. So that it cancels out in the wash, so to speak. That is to say, yes, the startups are unreliable, but we all know from our own horrible experiences in a so-called airline hell that the other airlines are equally adept at being extremely unreliable, whether it's United, if I'm not picking on Air Canada, or Delta, or WestJet, any of these airlines.
But we know they're not going to fold up operations overnight the way a lot of these ones have, like Fly Globespan and others before them. And that's, I think that plays into the minds of people before they go and buy a ticket. A lot of people are going to say, yeah, that looks attractive, $89, $99. And yeah, I don't care if I have to pay for a pillow or a soft drink or an air sick bag or whatever it is. I just don't trust that. Yeah. And, you know, brand, as you know, is all about how people feel about a company or a product or a service. And so I just wonder, boy, oh boy, these guys are real mavericks that take these chances. I don't know.
You know, I don't dispute what you just said, and it's certainly not for everyone. I mean, those people who like their comforts and want the full royal treatment, they're going to fly business class in Air Canada. They're not going to go to the budget airlines, the discount airlines. They're not. But there is a substantial market out there for discount airlines, proven by the fact of the success, the remarkable success of JetBlue and Lion Air and Southwest Airlines and so on.
Again, those are American, though. American and European. That's, I guess, sorry to interrupt you, Ian, but I just feel instinctively that we just view things differently in Canada. Maybe I'm wrong.
I do think, I'm going to have to respectfully disagree with you.
Okay.
I'm not saying all Canadians, by no means all Canadians, but we're not talking a mainstream, this is a niche product that's going to appeal to a small subset of travelers.
Right.
those who are willing to take the risk, because they say, gee whiz, a $59 ticket, it's worth it to me, because I still think the chances are very good that the plane will depart on time and I won't lose my money. So I think that there's a maybe it's 20% of the flyer market. So 80% of the flyer market, the passenger market isn't interested. Well, they're not trying to attract the entire market.
Right. They know who their clients are. Yeah, they know who they want to. They know who their who their target market is, and that's always the first rule for business success, right? Know who you're trying to speak to and get to buy your product. So,
absolutely.
I don't know how. It'd be interesting to see how this goes. I hope, you know, I always hope that new business that anywhere near our city does well. I definitely have hopes. We'll have to, I guess, wait and see. It'll be interesting. Are there any, to your mind, Ian, are there any other companies like New Leaf out there competing for that same discount passenger?
Well, Frontier Airlines in doing that, similar to that. There's a slight wrinkle. They're going to very small airports like Ogdensburg, which is an hour from Ottawa, and they rebranded the airport in Ogdensburg, New York. They call it Ogdensburg/Ottawa. And the Buffalo Airport, I understand, is doing the same thing. They're calling themselves Buffalo-Toronto, and the one in near the border, the Vancouver border, the BC border, is they're giving it the American name / Vancouver, and they're trying to compete and attract customers who are tired of paying the very high Air Canada fees and WestJet fees, and which are very high, and partly because of landing fees, partly because taxes are higher here, partly because fuel taxes are higher, and so forth. And so they're also flying into small Tier 2 airports, and they're trying to attract Canadians who are very price-sensitive. So, I mean, there's a market out there for people who are price-sensitive, students, retired people on modest incomes, people, who are maybe middle class, lower middle class, and they're trying to stretch their travel dollars. So there's a market out there. It's not the business travelers. It's not the executives. It's not the public servants on business. It's just about everybody else.
All right. All right, Ian Lee, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University in the nation's capital. Thank you so much for spending some time with us, Ian. Always a pleasure to chat. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on AM 900 CHML.
The resignation of Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who is, of course, the DNC party chairwoman. She said on ABC's this week, Sunday morning, that she would be resigning. Bernie Sanders and his crew says she should be resigning immediately and not attending the convention, but she says, no, I've got duties to perform at the convention and I'll do it after the fact. And a lot of people are saying, well, that kind of stinks. Barry Kay is with us, political science professor at Wilfrid Laurier University. Barry, thanks for being on the show today.
Good morning.
So let's start with that. Let's start with the Wasserman Schultz situation, because it seems to be the more controversial thing to be discussing this morning. You know, should she be not appearing at the convention?
Well, I think she's going to appear. I mean, she has to have save a little bit of face as well in all of this. Look, the chairman of the National Committee, Democratic or Republican, is not a huge national issue. It's sort of a story for the moment. A week from now, people aren't going to be talking about this this much at all. The candidates are going to be Trump and Clinton and perhaps their vice presidential running mates. Even they aren't all going to be all that significant. But it is a story for the moment. And the fact is, Debbie Wasserman Schultz allowed her partisanship within the Democratic Party, that is the race for the nomination, to show unnecessarily and gratuitously and frankly stupidly. She has become a story for the moment. As I say, I think it will blow over very quickly. But she may be booed. In fact, she probably will be booed this afternoon when she gavels in the meeting. And if she has remarks, they will probably be very very brief. She spoke actually at the Florida delegation this morning, and she was booed there. So that'll kind of be embarrassing, and the media will sort of latch onto the story for the moment. But as I say, within a couple of days, I think this will be largely forgotten.
Are people involved in political circles more, I guess, willing to be more outspoken today than they were maybe, a decade ago or even a couple of decades ago, because they of what you just said, because it's so flash in the pan, because our attention spans are so tight, and you know, it's out there and then it's gone in no time. The news cycle's so quick that now it's almost like they have license to be a little more edgy.
Well, yeah, I'm sure that's true. There's just more tape. There's more time available. There's the need for more stories to be filled. Look, the media has one of the biases that clearly exists among the media. It's not so much just left and right, but it's for controversy and confrontation. And any story that shows any little bit of that, the media is going to hype up to even greater levels. A week ago, we were talking about the plagiarism of Melania Trump's speech. Although that actually didn't blow over as quickly as it might have if the Republicans had handled it better, that blew over too. There'll be another story tomorrow and another the next day. The big stories, though, are going to be the ones that are determined by the candidates themselves and their campaigns.
So, what are the other things that we north of the 49th parallel, who might not, normally be in touch with, paying attention to coverage of conventions like these, be looking at?
Oh, I think the Democrats will want to have as feel-good a convention as they can. Tonight, the speakers are going to be Elizabeth Warren. In fact, she'll be the keynoter, the senator from Massachusetts, who actually, I think, is a much more effective representative in terms of catalyzing the left wing of the Democratic Party, even than Bernie Sanders. If she had chosen to run, and there was talk about that some months ago, if she had chosen to run, it would have been her rather than Bernie, who would have been sort of the emblem of the left, and she would have probably done better. I'm not sure if she would have beaten Hillary. At the time, it wouldn't have seemed likely. In hindsight, maybe she would have had a chance. But she will speak. Bernie will speak. Tonight is really the left wing's, within the Democratic Party's night to shine. And by and large, I think even though they are going to point out some differences with the sort of the more mainstream Democrats, that in fact they are going to endorse them in a way that the Republicans never really did all that much endorsing. Now, endorsements we've come to see don't make all that much difference at the end of the day either. But one way to look at the Republicans will be looking for any, and the media will be looking for any story that shows confrontation, and that's just the way the news cycle works. But I think, in fairness, the Democrats are probably going to come out of this week more united than the Republicans. I'm not sure it even matters at the end of the day, because Donald Trump is such a different kind of candidate. A lot of the Republicans, of course, express themselves by not showing up at all. Democrats are coming to their convention. There are going to be a number of prominent speakers. As I say, tonight's story is going to be about the left. They will point out differences on issues perhaps like foreign trade from the mainstream, but by and large, they are going to get in line behind the Democrats, and the Democrats will point out the fact that whatever booing or differences might be evident at their convention, they're in better shape in that regard than the Republicans.
Their city officials in Philadelphia are a little concerned about protests, and some of it, or a fair amount of that, has to do with weather conditions down there. They're in extreme heat, like we've been around here for the last little while. And when you get extreme heat and you get extreme thoughts and points of view, then sometimes crazy things happen. I wonder, again, if that begins to be the story, then does everything else get a little bit lost? I suppose it does.
Oh, I don't know. The weather can affect these things. I gather, because I was watching some of the cable news channels this morning, that it's been raining in Philadelphia as well, kind of like it's been up our area here. And my hunch is that if there's more rain, there's probably going to be less obvious demonstrations, right, and the media probably won't want to spend as much time out in the rain covering it. Look, Cleveland, the demonstrations, and there were demonstrations there, the demonstrations in Cleveland were very much kept under control and probably got less media attention, were less newsworthy than many expected. They will be there if the media wants to cover people, when the Black Lives Matter or other groups that are out there, they'll have the opportunity. Unless there's something new and different about the demonstrations, my hunch is the people that want to protest the system have to come up with some kind of gimmick to really get the kind of attention that they would really like to totally change the story. And unless there is some sort of new, just having marches doesn't seem to do it so much anymore in terms of the massive coverage that in years gone by they've gotten. That, I don't want to say it can't happen, but given what happened in Cleveland, I'm not expecting the protests to be a primary focus of this week's news coverage.
Barry Kay is my guest, political science professor at Wilfrid Laurier University. Barry, could you ever imagine an American election quite like this one, with two candidates that seem to be, by most points of view, inadequate?
The least popular. I teach American politics, and it's great fun to cover for this reason. I may have mentioned before on the air that my first day in class, I always tell students that indeed American government is more to be enjoyed than admired. We should be grateful here that our politics isn't quite so exciting most of the time. It's quite dysfunctional in all sorts of ways we're not even getting into at the moment. No, one, I wouldn't have imagined this. I wouldn't have imagined that money would have played such a small role in the selection of the candidates, that endorsements would play such a small role, that TV ads, all of these things are different, not just about Trump and Clinton, but indeed about the whole electoral process. It keeps changing every 4 years. There's something a little bit different, perhaps never as distinctive from historical precedent as this year. No, I couldn't have anticipated that, but each of Clinton and Trump emerged for different kinds of reasons, and there clearly are constituencies both for and against them within their parties. It's certainly going to make a fun confrontation. One thing we should understand, not just about this week, but as we move toward November, is that indeed America is fairly evenly divided and polarized. It doesn't mean we're going to necessarily have a 50-50 election, but it does mean that we're not going to see the dramatic blowouts of, you know, years gone by, where Reagan carried virtually every state in the Union in 84, and the same happened with Johnson before that, and with Richard Nixon in 72. American elections now are pretty much fixated on 7 or 8 swing states. There may be a couple of other states that will change gears, but there's only, and again, I can repeat them if you'd like, but I think people that are interested in this sort of have a sense, but it's states like Ohio and perhaps Pennsylvania and Florida and Virginia and Colorado and Iowa, perhaps, that in fact the election is going to be determined, and that indeed most of the attention in the election, candidates will go around to other parts of the country, but by and large, it's those, you know, 7 or 8 swing states that are going to determine the outcome. And in recent years, the Democrats have tended to do disproportionately better. The one reason why, in fact, I think Hillary Clinton has to be given an edge right now, I don't think she's even ahead in the polls after the Republican convention, has to be given the edge, though, that she does have a much more organized campaign and more money to fight the campaign.
So then we can probably expect to see her turn the jets on a little bit when the general campaign gets going, because one of the things that occurred to me was it seemed to me in the... when Trump was running around, you know, saying the most controversial things and grabbing all the media attention, the headlines, it felt to me like Hillary Clinton was pretty quiet when he was doing that. And maybe that was a strategy, just be quiet and let this guy look like a buffoon.
And hope that, not everyone who supports, you know, thinks he's a buffoon. I tend to, but there are people that are certainly on the other side. He's doing extremely well among people that haven't gone to college, especially white men that haven't gone to college, much better than the past. And many of those people would have been blue-collar Democrats in years gone by. So there's some uncertainty associated with that. Hillary Clinton is not a particularly charismatic or exciting figure that people are drawn to. But the fact that Trump is controversial, the fact that Trump has gone out of his way to unnecessarily antagonize so many groups, particularly women and minority groups, but others as well. And indeed, I think he's going to sort of get an awful lot of negative attention in terms of the foreign policy implications of what he said. We haven't really gone into the discussion about this WikiLeaks release about the Democratic convention, but there's some interesting matters suggesting that indeed the original hacking took place on the part of Russian intelligence organizations some months ago, but that it was leaked now right at the beginning of the Democratic convention to hopefully, from their perspective, to embarrass the Democrats. So what you've got is Vladimir Putin's forces effectively trying to interfere with the American election campaign.
Wow.
David Sanger has, if your listeners might want to pay attention, they might go online to the New York Times site today and look at David Sanger's column. I think it's one of the lead columns on the website. Just talking about some of the interesting connections between Paul Manafort, who was in fact doesn't have the title campaign manager, but he's effectively running the Trump campaign at the moment. In the past, he's actually been a lobbyist for Russian connected interests in terms of American politics. Now, I don't want to make this sound like too much of a conspiracy theory yet. I don't think the Trump organization or is orchestrating all of this, but there's a lot of interesting issues, a lot of shoes that are going to drop over the coming weeks, including Trump's positions on foreign policy, speaking positively about about Putin and about some other strong strongman leaders in you know, on the other side of the world, that I think those issues are also going to have an effect. We still are over three months out from the election. A lot of things are going to happen between now and then. But I think those stories are going to very much dwarf the comings and goings of the convention that we're talking about this week.
It's I just can't believe what we have in front of us here. And I wonder how the rest of the world is looking at these two candidates. In particular, I know this week it's the Democratic National Convention, but how people are looking around the world at a guy like Donald Trump and trying to imagine him being the president of the United States.
Putin's probably happy, but
yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Europeans, I'm sure, are petrified because, in fact, he's much less committed to NATO. He's much less committed to the idea of a unified Europe. He was cheering for the Brexit, basically the Britain's departure from the EU, and indeed, again, he's. To say he's an isolationist is too simplistic, but in fact, he certainly is involved in disengaging. He wants America to be less involved in the world than it has been. And people in other parts of the world, maybe even in Canada, he's spoken critically of the North American Free Trade Organization. That would have implications for us. I'm not sure he can undo many of the things he's talked about, including the wall with Mexico and stopping Muslims from coming to the country. A lot of that, even if he should get elected, and I doubt that's going to happen, but even if he should get elected, his ability to just unilaterally change all these things he's talking about is very, very dodgy. He's got all sorts of constitutional implications and problems with Congress. The U.S. president actually has much less power to change domestic policy in the U.S. than our prime minister does here. So a lot of these things that people are afraid of are probably not going to happen, even if he got elected. But yeah, he certainly can mess things up. And because America is such an important country internationally, I'm sure he's got a lot of people on the edge of their seats very fearful about what the future might hold.
And you know, people watch so much television, they probably think that Trump thinks that this is an episode of Celebrity Apprentice or The Apprentice or something. And at the same time, what can we learn from Kevin Spacey in House of Cards when it comes to this kind of stuff? I mean, I'm being cute, but you know, there's a lot of people out there, Barry, who think that's it, and maybe, I don't know, is House of Cards more of a true representation of what really goes on in Washington?
No, but it's great entertainment. but clearly, the fact that Trump has emerged in this way is very much dependent upon the television image he was able to create as the strong figure. It's noteworthy, again, that it's less educated people that are most likely to be drawn in, but people who are genuinely angry and upset and fearful. Fear and anger has a lot to do with the components of Trump's appeal, and it's certainly the way the Republicans ran their convention last week.
I mean, that is the scariest thing of all, because history has proven that when you've got lots of fear and anger out there, that the outcomes are generally not very good.
Yeah, a lot of it's manufactured. I mean, the notion that America, you know, the crime is running rampant. America's probably had less crime than ever in the past by most statistics. There's still murders going on in Chicago. It's not perfect, but it's the media that creates a certain kind of impression about this because of the fact that they are focusing on stories that are sensationalistic, and that very much plays to Trump's strength. Again, I'm personally not that fearful that Trump is going to emerge at the end of the day, but it is going to be close. And indeed, in the 3 months plus to come, there's a lot of shoes that are going to drop. To me, foreign policy and also Trump's questionable business dealings in the past. I mean, he's not prepared to show his income tax. I'm not even sure he pays taxes based on, you know, stories I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
There are embarrassments out there that I think are going to haunt Trump as well, but it's going to be a competitive election, and the media is just going to eat this stuff up.
Barry Kay, political science professor, Wilfrid Laurier University. Appreciate your time. Thanks for being with us today.
Happy to talk to you.
You're listening to The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on AM 900 CHML.
Talking about LRT, and get your dialing fingers ready, because I do want to get your thoughts and opinions on this. 905-645-3221 or *9900, our telephone numbers to call. You can email me, jwest at westpromedia.com. And LRT, Terry Whitehead, city councilor for Ward 8, has a report coming out today that questions LRT and its viability in our city. And he says that his report offers perspective and a caution. Terry Whitehead, good to talk to you again. Welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you, Jamie, and to all your listeners this morning.
Very interesting report you've got here, 58 pages in all, released on your website. And it's really taking a careful look at the validity of some of the pro-LRT talking points. And I think we should start by saying, you're not an anti-LRT guy. You say right in your remarks that you're pro-LRT, but LRT done right.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, we started this journey a number of years ago and dealt at the highest level. A conceptual idea, and you know, a number of reports came in, and you know, in retrospect, consider those reports being challenged to a greater degree and a higher level of scrutiny. More likely, that should have happened. It didn't, but we were not at the granular level, and I don't think anyone expected at that time that we would get any funding from the provincial government to fund a $1 billion LRT program. But if you follow that path, I mean, the original reports talked about, the big move was about dealing with congestion issues, and certainly in the lower city, there's no congestion levels to speak of. So at some point, it transformed into something different. It transformed into what was called a city building. And lo and behold, that was the justification for LRT. It was concerning when I started reading the reports and saw inconsistencies. And when you read reports, you got to so your listeners know, a lot of these reports are done are falling back on other reports, and those reports sometimes fall back on other reports. So it was a bit of a domino in regards to chasing the best information to understand the conclusions they arrive at. When I started doing that, I started realizing that there seemed to be a little more inconsistencies in the reports that were given. I'm going to give you an example. For example, they identify five very successful cities with LRT, but what they don't tell you, and they don't make any reference to it, is that there was 25, I believe, or 28 on that list that didn't succeed. So of the 28, the only five that list were the successful ones.
Right.
So that's a bit misleading in my humble opinion, and we need to learn lessons from those ones that didn't succeed. We shouldn't be hiding from the worst case scenarios. We should need to understand them and improve on them so that we don't have failure in the city of Hamilton.
Well, where is the push coming from then? I mean, if those reports are out there, and I've heard them too. I mean, I can remember particularly University of Waterloo president coming on saying you don't need it in Hamilton. Hamilton isn't set up that way. You don't have the issues that would require an LRT to come in and serve the community and improve it.
Well, that's absolutely, you know, doing the due diligence and going through dozens of reports and actually even going to the point of interviewing a woman, Jenny, who's an economist with the Federal Reserve for Transportation, has done a number of studies on the economics of LRT systems. When I indicate to her that we're building it for economic reasons, she basically said, stop right there, you're going to fail.
Is that right?
And I said, what do you mean? She said, first of all, there's no evidence of that anywhere, reliable evidence. She said, in most cases, all it is a shifting of building, but it's not a net benefit for the community. And that even then, you could and will have areas where you may have some uplift, but other areas on the same corridor that will actually go down as a result of the LRT systems going through those locations.
Well, that sounds a little frightening. Then the question becomes: then why do it? If we know that, for example, ridership on buses is not I don't know. The last time I checked, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong here, I'm using a rough number, somewhere around 10% of the population uses the buses. They those are people that obviously need public transit. They got to have a way to get around. But are we not still basically in love with our cars around here? Is Hamilton really a tough place to get around in an automobile? I mean, I hear people all the time say, and as a longtime resident here, a lifetime resident, I don't find it difficult to get around in a car or a bus. Just invest the money in buses.
Yeah.
I don't
so
know.
I would say to you that it's a little bit of both. I mean, we need to be moving to a more environmentally responsible way of moving people in our community.
Okay.
But what is that solution? I can tell you in the model that we're dealing with now, most transit systems actually did everything they could not to impact the current traffic volumes on those networks. They went over and above to try and not impact that. In Hamilton, we're actually going to be impacting 20,000 vehicles along that corridor. There is no example of this anywhere in North America. Another really key point in this research is that most successful, all successful LRTs, or the only successful LRTs, are ones that go from a destination location to a destination location. That is not what we've signed up for here. We're going from the middle of a node to McMaster University. Now, if we kept the original one to Eastgate, then at least we met that criteria. We don't have nowhere near the congestion like Ottawa and that to justify, as you indicated earlier, an LRT system at this point in time. The ridership time, by the way, is no different in the LRT from the location of the City of Motor Hotel to McMaster than the bus system. So let's not get carried away with the time differential. There isn't any.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to land on, because I think people have an idea, oh, it's a tram or a train, and it's rapid, and it'll be fast. It'll be faster, but it's not the case. It's going to stop a million times.
Being quoted saying 25 minutes, and basically that's what our bus service will be delivering it at. The other problem is our ridership is... Well, our base ridership on the B line is 444. I think it's called peak hour. I'm going to get that terminology wrong, but it's a peak hour reverse peak hour load. We need to be having around 2,000 just to offset the operating cost. Now, in the IBI report, it suggests that we won't even hit 1,800 until 2031. So who carries those operating costs? Right. How much more is going to cost the taxpayers? And it's been done in one corridor of the city. Now, when you look, and I talked to, like, again, talking to the experts, Jenny from the Federal Reserve, we talked about BRT, and she indicated to me that there's many cases that BRT has had very good uplift, equivalent to LRT, and she was a bit surprised that we were not going with the A line and B line in Hamilton for $800 million. The net for the city, now for the city of Hamilton, the net uplift, city building uplift, would be greater than the $1 billion investment in one corridor. And yet, when you looked at the reports, Metrolinx, when they did the comparative BRT to LRT, what they don't say in that report is they were only comparing one $400 million line to the $1 billion LRT line on one corridor. They didn't take the other piece and add that into the equation. If they had, it would have been overwhelming that a BRT would have had a greater uplift for the city of Hamilton. And it's unfortunate that that wasn't captured in those original reports.
Yeah, Terry, I tell you another thing that makes me shudder. I've just started coming back to the downtown core in the last few years, for obvious reasons. There's a lot of reasons to come into the downtown core, in the last few years. But you're going to start tearing up, the sections of the downtown core. Those businesses are going to die down there when they start building this thing. It's, you've said earlier, it's not one of your experts has said, it's not an economic driver. This is frightening to me, because I want to see the momentum continue with our downtown core. I think a lot of people feel that way.
Yeah, so I want to make it clear that this report gives fruit for thought. I mean, I want people to really get into and engaged in this discussion, understand the rest of the data that hasn't been put out there publicly,
right?
That was hidden in these reports or buried in subsequent reports that never were relied on, and they need to be relied on, because they are the essence of us making good decisions in this community. So from my perspective, if $1 billion wasn't on the table right now, there's no question that BRT is the way to go for City of Hamilton, because there's a greater uplift and you meet the needs of a far greater geographic area and population for transit needs. And like Jenny said, you should be building this for transit needs first. Economic reasons are subsequent to that. So now we're in this box where $1 billion is being offered. And in my report, it does have a quote from Wynn that says it's not LRT or nothing. But if that's desire and the way that people want to go, we need to understand the plan as is, as it stands today, in my mind, will undoubtedly fail us and fail this community. But we can make it a success, but that would require another $220 million investment in the Rapid Ready Plan to put those blast networks in to feed that system and not starve it, put the ride share programs in, park and ride programs in, again, to accommodate people accessing that public transit system. So without that, I'm in fear that the system as it is planned today, that's why we need to have this dialogue, will fill.
Terry, how engaged are your constituents and the constituents in other wards across the city as you kind of take the pulse? Are people really engaged in this, or is this just the politicians out there talking a lot about this? Do you hear from people about this? And when you talk to your council colleagues, do they indicate whether people are really engaged?
I think right now it's very visceral. I think that people hear it. You know, you go along the mountain, I can tell you that majority of people you talk to aren't supportive of $1 billion in this one corridor. I can tell you if you go in other locations of the city, I'm sure you'll find very, very strong support for the LRT. So I would suggest that we have a divided community, a significantly divided community on this question. I think as a councillor and as leaders in this community, it's incumbent upon us with this kind of investment that we do it right, and we do it right the first time.
Well, I agree with you there. As a taxpayer in the city of Hamilton, it would be wonderful if we had a project that's this big done right. And I don't want to start talking about stadiums because that'll get me in trouble.
So, Jamie, can I do one more thing? I do
sure.
want to ask people because we really, and I want to talk, thank Howard Rabb, who was the assistant that worked alongside me and pulled a lot of this information together. We worked in collaboration, and he's done a wonderful job. I want to thank him. And I want to extend to your listeners or anyone that has any interest in LRT, I think they're almost obligated to take a look at my site at terrywhitehead@hamilton.ca and go to that report and read it thoroughly. Look at and all the reference material is associated in each category. So I have a category for Hamilton LRT, economic uplift, operating costs, ridership, proposed LRT speed, Hamilton versus Ottawa LRT, and other concerns. And I have the supporting documentation and evidence that you can easily tab on each of those in each of those areas. So it's all referenced.
Great. Terry Whitehead, City Councilor, Ward 8, with that new report out. Thank you so much for this. I appreciate the time. Thanks.
Thank you.
The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on AM 900 CHML.